Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about a Billings police-involved shooting, what a majority of Montanans think about the impeachment inquiry, and wildfire resistance. It's Thursday, October 10th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The group tasked with addressing Montana's backlog of untested rape kits is planning a series of statewide trainings and revamping the sexual assault investigation training for officers in the state. Kayla DeRoche has more.
The Montana Department of Justice established its Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, or SACI, in 2015 with federal funds. It's a response to the backlog of almost 1,300 sexual assault kits that were found untested in Montana. Since then, SACI has worked with local law enforcement to investigate all the kits, leading to the arrest of one perpetrator. At the 2019 Crime Prevention Conference in Billings this week, SACI Training Coordinator Brian Fisher said the Montana Law Enforcement Academy will adopt a new curriculum for sexual assault investigation training in January. It replaces what Fisher called an insufficient four-hour sexual assault investigation training with a more intensive 12-hour course that includes a victim interview simulation and a pass-fail exam. Fisher said Montana is working to teach officers best practices when following up on sexual assault cases, like how to broach difficult, uncomfortable conversations in one-on-one interactions with survivors.
And part of it is that how do you say that? How do you have the conversation? How do you ask questions that aren't going to be re-traumatizing? Because that's what the majority of the officers found, is that they were fearful of re-traumatizing the survivor of that crime.
Also, starting between now and early 2020, he said SACI will hold trainings across the state for criminal justice professionals, most likely starting in eastern Montana, in rural areas with fewer resources. The Montana legislature unanimously passed a bill this year that requires law enforcement agencies to submit most rape kits for testing within 30 days. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The Billings Police Department is investigating an officer-involved shooting that happened early yesterday morning. I found out more. The incident, which happened in the span of about 60 seconds, left one officer with minor injuries and the suspect with non-life-threatening gunshot wounds. Just before 3 a.m. Wednesday morning, two Billings police officers fired multiple rounds on a 30-year-old white male in a stolen truck after he rammed into several police cruisers. Police Chief Rich St. John shared details at a press conference Wednesday morning.
Potentially the first time that he runs into an officer possibly trying to get away. The second time, though, when he backs into those two police cars, my opinion only, that was an intentional aggressive act to injure or kill police officers.
Officers Tracy Eichhard and Brett Hildy surrounded the white Ford pickup at a gas station just north of downtown. The driver reversed into Eichhard's cruiser and then drove forward into a fence. Hildy began to approach the truck on foot when Officer Jeremy Beckel arrived. Beckel parked his police car behind Hildy's and exited the cruiser. The suspect reversed again and rammed into Hildy's car with enough force to deploy the airbags, total the cruiser, and push it into Beckel's vehicle. Police Chief Rich St. John.
Both cars were pushed all the way through the lot to a point where Beckel's car was spun 45 degrees and ended up partially on North 27th.
Officer Eichhard had moved his car into a blocking position when the suspect accelerated forward again.
Fearing that Officer Eichhard would be rammed again and others would be at risk, the officers fired multiple rounds at the driver's side door. The suspect was hit multiple times and stopped accelerating. Still, the momentum carried the truck forward and Eichhard was hit again.
Officers Hildy and Beckel will be on administrative leave for at least 2 weeks, according to BPD policy. Police cannot identify the suspect, but said he's a Billings resident and has an extensive criminal record. Chief St. John said the BPD will take its time to investigate and bring charges forward. Earlier this year, the Billings Gazette found that while BPD has jurisdiction over 10% of the state's population, it accounts for 33% of fatal shootings by officers. Tribal leaders in Montana are pulling out of the Attorney General's task force for missing and murdered Indigenous people after he announced his intent to support the Keystone XL pipeline in court. Olivia Reingold reports.
The Attorney General of Montana, Republican Tim Fox, appointed members to the task force this spring. Now, some are resigning because Fox, who's running for governor, wants to join a lawsuit in support of the Keystone XL pipeline.
He's shaking your hand with one hand, but on the back, he's crossing his fingers and telling the state to go forward with this pipeline.
Assiniboine and Sioux tribal member Justin Dupree is one of two who've resigned since Monday. The task force has 11 members, including 8 tribal representatives. The only tribal member who could be reached in time for broadcast says she's considering leaving the task force and is talking it over with her tribe. Dupree says man camps that house temporary pipeline workers would increase violence and missing persons cases. That's something he worries about for his two daughters. Pipeline projects and crime rates are connected, according to the recent Canadian inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. The pipeline would cross the Missouri River a quarter mile upstream from the Fort Peck Nation. Dupree says the pipeline would economically develop some parts of the state, but
the reservation is going to see a majority of the bad things that follow that.
Fox says the pipeline would be an economic boon for the state, primarily filling the 7 counties it's supposed to cross with $63 million in property taxes. Because of that economic interest, he filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit to support the pipeline Monday. But I guess, what do you have to say to the tribes of Montana, specifically Fort Belknap, who say, hey, this wouldn't benefit us, we don't want this?
Well, I think that I haven't looked at that statement. I don't know that that's a correct statement, because the tax revenues from the pipeline being built alone will be a benefit to all Montanans.
Former task force member Dupree says the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes won't be able to collect on the pipeline's property taxes because it won't cross into Roosevelt County, where the reservation is located. He says it could affect the tribe's water supply. In an emailed statement, Fox says he's disappointed task force members are resigning. There's a conference call scheduled Thursday to discuss the development of a database to track missing persons cases. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
A former Montana tribal police officer who stole $40,000 from a youth diversion program has been sentenced to 6 months in prison. Willard Wilson White III was sentenced yesterday and ordered to pay restitution in addition to more than $18,000 in back taxes. Prosecutors say the 44-year-old Glasgow man approached the Fort Peck Law and Justice Committee in 2015 with a proposal for a program to help youth avoid incarceration. He spent all of the funds on himself without providing any services. A majority of Montana voters do not think President Donald Trump should be impeached, according to a poll from the University of Montana released this week. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
52% of Montana voters polled say they do not think Trump should be impeached and removed from office. 39% say he should, and 10% say they don't know. The Big Sky poll from UM surveyed 300 Montana voters in late September through early October. That was soon after U.S. House Democrats launched the formal impeachment inquiry. Sarah Rinfrey co-directs the poll in the university's Department of Public Administration and Policy.
Montanans are not supportive of it overwhelmingly, but there's more movement, women versus men.
Montana women support impeachment nearly 7% more than men, though more men and women say Trump shouldn't be impeached. UM's Big Sky poll also shows a divide in how urban and rural voters in the state feel about impeachment. Rural voters are much less likely to support the idea. While generally Democrats are for and Republicans are against impeachment, independent voters haven't broken a majority on either side. More say they don't think the president should be removed from office, but 16% of independents say they're undecided. The Montana poll comes with a margin of error of plus or minus 5.6%. According to analysis of national polls by the website 538, at the time of the Big Sky poll release, more Americans support impeachment than are against it. I'm Corin Cates Carney, Montana Public Radio News.
As fire season winds down, managers are intentionally setting fires to brush piles, slash, and even large sections of forests in an effort to prevent out-of-control wildfires in future seasons. As Nikki Ouellette reports, a group of scientists from Montana and Idaho recently published a paper arguing that strategies like these should be a part of a radical rethinking of how people in the West live with fire.
Dave McQuethy says Montana has passed a tipping point. Summers are hotter and drier, which means fire season lasts longer, and our approach to put every single fire out, like we've done for the past 100 years, just isn't realistic anymore.
The big take-home message is that we can't respond the way we've been responding in the past to wildfire.
McQuethy is an assistant professor of earth sciences at Montana State University. In a recent article in Nature Sustainability, McQuethy and his co-authors argue that people living in the West need to reconsider how we live with and even harness fire if we want to continue living here in the future.
We have to make changes. And one of the great things that we have to do that is how we used to use fire as a tool in the past.
McQuethy's team found a model in the Netherlands where, instead of fighting rising sea levels with taller and taller dams, engineers built an infrastructure system designed to work with water instead of fight it.
And instead of kind of rebuilding in the same way that they have in the past, they've decided to transform how they accept or live with these hazards. And so it's really just coming back to this idea that fire is a part of Western landscapes. It was in the past, it is today, and it's going to be in the future. And becoming more comfortable with the fact that with warming temperatures and a longer fire season, the best way that we can move into the future is really to accept fire as a natural process and start to think about how can we use fire itself to safeguard our communities.
Where might it make more sense for humans to take a more active or proactive approach to preparing for and living with fire?
Yeah, I mean, almost everywhere in Montana where people are living, it's a great place to think about adaptive resilience. And that really just means that we're making changes to protect communities and people where there's anything that's flammable, any flammable vegetation. So we can think about building materials that are less flammable. Even if we're in homes that have already been built, there's a lot of things we can do around what we call the home ignition zone. And that's just creating a defensible space when there are fires that occur. And the easiest way to do that is just to remove woody fuels around the home.
You and your co-authors also suggest some pretty radical rethinking of even how we design neighborhoods and communities. You've suggested that maybe parking lots or playgrounds could act as vegetationless safe spaces, designing neighborhoods and communities so that there are roads going in and out so that people don't become trapped. You also suggest that we could consider building underground or physical barriers to protect homes. Like, I guess, how did you guys come up with these ideas, and what are you kind of envisioning as a fire-adapted community?
We need to really start thinking about where we have repeated very severe fires under very extreme conditions. Are these the places that we want to rebuild in the same way that we have in the past? And there's places that we want to start thinking about that, even in Montana, where there's a lot of fuel and where there's people living right in the fuels in these dense forests. That's something that we should be thinking about. And we're not saying that, you know, every community should be using the same approach. That's one of the lessons we've learned from looking at communities that have achieved some success in protecting themselves from fires, is that they've all used kind of a unique suite of approaches.
You argue that maybe we should be taking it even a step beyond that homeowner responsibility and just having a profound shift in the way that humans relate to fire. You call it bouncing forward in your paper. And can you describe what that might look like or where it could be applied effectively?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can learn from folks in eastern Montana in the tribes who have really recognized that fire is a tool that can really help protect communities. And it's useful for a number of reasons. And have been using fire for, you know, centuries to kind of manage fuels and make landscapes safer for people to live, and also just promote well-being in terms of preparing land for agriculture or ranching. On tribal lands, folks use fire to promote certain types of vegetation that are desirable or very culturally important. And I think we can learn from that.
Are there places in Montana where it would make sense to just try to bring things back exactly how they were before a fire came through?
Yes, in more remote areas, in, for example, in parts of Glacier National Park, in Yellowstone National Park, other high elevation forests. If a fire comes through, it might make a lot of sense just to let that forest regenerate however it regenerates.
There's a chance, with temperatures continuing to rise and drought becoming more prevalent, there's a chance that if we do use fire to fight fire and do these prescribed burns, as you're suggesting, that landscapes are not going to come back as they've looked in the past. How should people be thinking about that as we kind of move into a drier, hotter future?
Previous research from folks all over the West is showing that in some settings, because of the changing conditions, after wildfires, we're not seeing forests regenerate, and we're seeing these ecosystems transition to either scrub or grassland type systems. And one of the best ways we can deal with that is just to accept that, accept those transitions. And in some cases, we might want to be more proactive where there's an important ecosystem or vegetation type that we want to try to maintain. But we need to think about where that might be successful. In most cases, the best approach would be to just accept these transitions as they occur and really understand that these types of changes have occurred over the last several thousand years as conditions warmed or cooled with normal climate variability.
Why aren't more communities taking that transformative approach? What's so challenging about it?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that we haven't seen as many changes as we might expect is that we've had so much success controlling and limiting fires over the last 100 years, and now that's changing. We no longer can put out all fires when we have longer fire seasons and warmer conditions and extreme fire weather. So I think it's time for us to start thinking about transformation and adaptation. And if we do that now, we're going to have a much better chance of living with fire as opposed to kind of experiencing the real negative impacts of these really big, severe fires.
That was Montana State University professor Dave McQuethy speaking about his recent paper published in Nature Sustainability.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.